He said he had a couple of tests. Well, I've got one too. Whenever I visit a place, one of the tests that I have is, do they know how to show hospitality to a stranger? And you do. In fact, it's overwhelming, the reception that you have already given me. And the, I hope you know what you have here. The warmth of the embrace of this, this school and this campus. In fact, it's so much, I got to thinking about a crazy thing that happened to me not long ago. I had been invited down to Florida to preach in a Presbyterian church on Sunday. I'm Presbyterian. And so I flew down on Saturday, and I was met at the airport by an officer and his wife. And they said, welcome to Florida. I said, thanks. He said, listen, you're not going to be staying in a hotel tonight. You're going to be staying at our house. I said, great. And it's a great night to be there because once a month, our Sunday school class gets together for a party, and it's tonight at our house. You'll get a chance to meet some people from the church. Great. Well, it was a buffet supper. I was standing in line to get my food, and I was just trying to make small talk with the woman in front of me, and I said, it looks like it might rain. I hope that doesn't hurt attendance at church tomorrow. She turned around and said, it doesn't make any difference to me. I'm not going anyway. There's a guest minister in town. And I'll confess a sin. It was kind of nice to see her crawl under the buffet table when they introduced me later in the evening. Well, you've got a guest in town, but you have shown me great hospitality already, and I am glad to be here. I taught for a number of years at Princeton Theological Seminary, and there is a story that the old-timers around Princeton absolutely love to tell. It's about the day in the 1940s when a fashionable New York society matron drove down to Princeton in her touring car. She pulled up to the Princeton Inn, the most fashionable hotel in town in those days. She stepped out of her car, fished around in her purse until she found a quarter. She pressed it into the hand of the little man at the door of the hotel, take my luggage in immediately, and breezed regally into the lobby. Leaving the little man at the door of the hotel, who just happened to be Albert Einstein on his way to the lab, looking quizzically at the quarter in his hand. Finally, as the story goes, he shrugged his shoulders, picked up her luggage, and took it into the lobby. It was just a case of mistaken identity, misjudged appearance. She took one look at the little old guy and assumed he was the bellhop, rather than the greatest scientist of our time. This afternoon, I'm concerned with another case of mistaken identity and misjudged appearances. I'm concerned with one that takes place in thousands and thousands of pulpits every week in this land. It's the case of the mistaken identity and the misjudged appearance of the biblical text. We know what we're supposed to do as preachers. We're supposed to get down into the marrow of these biblical passages. Like Jacob, we're supposed to cling to them, begging them, speak to me that I may speak. And then when they have spoken to us, we're supposed to get up there in the pulpit and tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help us God about what they've said. We know what we're supposed to do, but we're busy. Being in the pastorate is a high-pressure job. There are demands on our times, meetings, people in the hospital. There are things that take away from our schedule. It gets to be late in the week. And so we take one look at the biblical passage and say, oh yeah, I know what you're about. We tip it a quarter and say, take my sermon into the church. What I want to do this afternoon is to talk about how it is that we may reclaim for ourselves both the power and the excitement of really looking at the biblical text. Now, here's some bad news. There's no way to disguise it. Biblical preaching is hard work done under pressure. There's simply no way to get to know a biblical text any easier than it is to get to know a friend. You have to spend some time with them in a variety of settings. Now, an old preacher one time wrote a book on preaching in which he said he thought we ought to spend an hour in the study for every minute in the pulpit. I don't know who wrote that, but I'm sure he was beloved by both of his members. Most of us do not have exactly that kind of time to spend on preaching, but if it is woven into the fabric of our week, if it becomes an exegetical habit that we protect, you know, you finish your sermons before your services, many of you, on Saturday. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm a kind of last-minute preparer. I'm a Sunday preacher, and so I finish on Saturday a lot of times. But finishing a sermon on Friday and beginning a sermon on Friday are two different things. And so if we will early in the week at least rough up the grain of the text so that it is like a frontlet between our eyes and everything that we experience during the week is passing through that text, we will have the joy of discovering what invigorates preaching more than anything else, and that is having something to say. And having something to say is a function of the encounter with the biblical text. Exegesis is the first habit to go for many ministers. And as a result, they domesticate and trivialize texts. Here's one that I've trivialized a number of times in preaching. It comes from the Gospel of Matthew. It's one of Jesus' parables, and he says this: "The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed in with 3 measures of flour until all is leavened." Simple. You take one look at it, you think you know what it's about, or at least I have always. It's about something small becoming something important and big. And so I preach silly little sermons like, "It may be small to you, but God is magnifying it." Oh, come on. Listen to this text. The kingdom of heaven. Now, when you say the kingdom of heaven, already you arouse in your listener's sensorium an expectation of what you're going to say. And when Jesus said the kingdom of heaven, all of his listeners thought military might. They thought the restoration of the Davidic Empire. They thought about the restorations of the fortunes of Israel and Jerusalem. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took. Suddenly, expectations are overturned. Now, we think of yeast, of course, as the little Fleischmann's packs that you buy at the grocery store. But if you look at the word yeast in the Bible, it is never used in a positive sense. Yeast is always a corrupting agent. Beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and Herod. On Passover, we eat unleavened bread. Yeast works by corruption. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast. It's like yeast that a woman took, and suddenly we're out of the muscular and masculine world and back into the domestic world of women where you don't expect anything in the first century to happen. But the kingdom of heaven is happening where women are taking yeast. And according to the New Revised Standard Version, she mixed it. Oh, what a terrible translation. In Krupsen. Encrypted, smuggled. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman smuggled into 3 measures of flour. In other words, sometimes the kingdom of heaven is a stealth operation. Sometimes the kingdom of heaven corrupts the corruption of the world. Now we got an interesting sermon going. Now, what I would like to talk to us about this afternoon is what might be called acoustical exegesis. Acoustical exegesis. Acoustical exegesis assumes that the biblical texts are not simply ideas contained in texts, that they are events contained in language. That whenever the biblical writers write, they don't just convey thoughts. They create language that causes an acoustical impact on those who hear. As you know, the Bible was written primarily for a culture in which not many people read, and it was designed to be read out loud. And the reading out loud of the text was in such a manner that something happened in the ears of those who heard that was theologically and personally important. Now, acoustical exegesis, we're going to develop that a little this afternoon, but it fits beautifully into the regular pattern of exegesis that we have been taught. We are the recipients, I would argue, of three big waves of biblical hermeneutics. All of them affect the way that we understand the Bible and the way that we preach. 500 years ago, the first wave passed over us. It passed over Protestants first, but then Roman Catholics, and this wave was, we began to understand that the biblical text was not abstracted from the human context, but grounded in the human context, that it is the product of particular times and circumstances, that it's historically shaped, and the fingerprints of history are all over the biblical text. And in order to understand its acoustical impact, part of what we have to do is to examine the historical context out of which the biblical passages we're preaching have come. For example, we think that the Gospel of Mark was written to a lower socioeconomic group. The recipients of the Gospel of Mark were themselves poor. We think that the Gospel of Luke was written to a mixed socioeconomic group, some rich, some poor. We think that the Gospel of Matthew was written to our first affluent congregation. You can tell it in Matthew. In Luke, it's blessed are the poor. In Matthew, it's blessed are the poor in spirit. Now, In each of those Gospels, Jesus sends the disciples out two by two. And when he does, he tells them, take no money. But the Greek is not the same. In Mark, it's take no copper, no pennies. In Luke, it's take no silver. But in Matthew, it's take no copper, silver, or gold. They're going out with gold American Express cards on the missionary trips from the Church of St. Matthew. Don't do that, said Jesus. In other words, the same word is grounded in the particularity of the historical context. So in Mark, Jesus catches the disciples arguing with each other about who is the greatest. They're on the road, they're arguing who's the greatest. And Jesus says to them in Mark, if you want to be great, you must become as one who serves. Note the language. If you want to be great, what does that imply about them? They aren't great. But if you want to be, you become a servant. The same conversation goes on in Luke, except it's not on the road, it's at the Last Supper. The disciples are arguing about who's the greatest at the Last Supper. And Jesus does not say to them the same thing he says in Mark. What he says in Luke is, those among you who are great must become as those who wait on tables. In other words, in the Lucan church, there are some people who live in the big house, and they have servants that wait on them. But when they come to the Lord's house, the economy is to be reversed, and those who have been powerful and affluent in the culture must become those who are servers at the table to act out the revolution of the kingdom of God. Historically grounded, about 125 years ago, another wave passed over us. Not only were texts historically grounded, they're also theologically shaped. The biblical writers weren't just neutral reporters, they were preachers, and they had theologies, and they were telling the stories according to their own theological angle of vision. And the theology of Mark is not exactly the same as the theology of Matthew or Luke or John. We don't have a monochromatic witness to Jesus Christ. We've got a choir. And not everybody's an alto, not everybody is a bass, not everybody's a soprano. You have to listen to the harmonies to get the fullness of the witness to Jesus Christ. For example, Matthew and John have somewhat different understandings of the theology of time. Matthew's theology is this: the kingdom of heaven is in the future. We're not there yet. We live in a Good Friday world. We're marching to Zion, beautiful. We're not there yet. You can tell it, by the way, in the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. You will be filled. Okay, future tense. John, however, it's almost as if John reaches out and takes that future kingdom in Matthew and pulls it like a canopy over ordinary time. Matthew, where's the kingdom? Ahead of us. John, where's the kingdom? Above us. And like a sewing machine in John, the kingdom keeps penetrating down into ordinary time, creating signs, experiences of the thing itself. You can tell that, by the way, in stories like John's version of Jesus' friend Lazarus, who is dead. Remember that? He's dead as a doornail, and Jesus is late to the funeral. In fact, he's in a holding pattern around Bethany, and he won't even go into town. Finally, it irritates Lazarus' sister Martha so much, she goes out and confronts him. If you had been here, my brother would not have died. To which Jesus says, your brother will rise again. To which Martha says, I know he will rise again on the last day. To which Jesus says, no, Martha, that's the Gospel of Matthew. We're in the Gospel of John here. I am the resurrection and the life. Now, I am grateful for these two different understandings of time because Matthew helps me watch CNN. I live in a Good Friday world, and my hope is in the future that God is going to bring in. John helps me understand ecstasy. How I can go to Walmart at 2 o'clock on Thursday afternoon and something will happen and the veil will lift. And I see the glory of God right there in Walmart on a Thursday afternoon. Now, about 75 years ago, to the first two waves that passed over us, historical and theological, a third wave passed over us. Not only are the biblical texts historically grounded, but they're theologically nuanced, but the biblical writers were poets and artists who knew how to pick just the right language to create the impact that they were trying to create. For example, the writer of the Gospel of John, again, who's a genius at this, has a literary pattern, a literary rhetorical pattern that he uses about 6 or 7 times in his gospel. I call it question, answer, dumb response. And here's the way it works. Somebody in John will ask Jesus a question. It'll be a good question, but it'll be a question at the mundane, routine, ordinary, everyday level of life. Jesus will answer the question, but he won't answer it at that level. He'll answer it at the level of Johannine Logos Christology, causing the answer to whistle right over the head of the person who's asked the question. And you can tell that they don't get it because they say something dumb. Now, keep in mind, this is a literary technique, not a historical technique. The people are not really dumb. This is a literary device. But you get it, for example, in John 4, the woman at the well. Here's the question. Why do you, a Jew, ask of me, a Samaritan woman, for a drink? That's a darn good question. Why would any Jewish male dare to break through theological, racial, and religious barriers to say anything to a Samaritan female? It was not done. Good question. Why do you, a Jew, ask of me, a Samaritan woman, for a drink? Answer. If you knew who was asking. You would have been free to ask him, and he would have given you living water. Where are you going to get the water? You hadn't even got a bucket. Now, that laughter is what John is after. Because in the laughter, you have discerned the irony of the text. He doesn't mean that water. He means living water. It's the power of rhetoric. Or take the ending of Paul's letter to the Philippians. You may remember at the ending of the letter, now keep in mind, this letter is being read out loud at Philippi. This is the sermon for the day. We've got a letter from our friend and brother Paul. So he's reading the letter out loud in worship. And all of a sudden, you get to the fourth chapter, and it says this. Euodia, Syntyche, knock it off. Get together in the Lord. Now, we don't know what was going on between Euodia and Syntyche. Probably Euodia like praise music and Syntyche like traditional hymns, but we don't really know. But suddenly, two women get their names called out loud in worship. As one commentator puts it a little anachronistically, at that point, two women sank a little lower in the pew. They were called out in worship. Now, you've got to ask yourself, why would Paul embarrass them like that? Why would he call out their name? Euodia, Syntyche, knock it off. But then it goes on to say, I want all of you who have worked with these women in the Lord to help them because your names are written in the book of life. He's reminding them acoustically that this is not the only time that those names have been called out loud in worship. I baptize you, Euodia. I baptize you, Syntyche. He's not calling them down. He's calling them up to their baptismal identity, the poetics of the text. Now, what I would like to do is to press these three registers, historical, theological, literary, rhetorical, forward by getting preachers to think about when this text was uttered out loud in a congregation of faithful, what was the impact of the text, the acoustical effect of the text? If you'll take a look at the handout, some of the texts that I want to deal with, not all of them, some of them are on this handout. Take a look at Exodus 22. Now, Exodus 22 is part of the legal code that we find in the Old Testament, and this is what is known as a casuistic law. Casuistic law. A casuistic law, we would call it today case law. Case law is law that applies only under certain conditions. The speed limit is 55, but if it is raining, the speed limit is 45. That's case law, the case being that it's raining. Now, sometimes the acoustical effect of an odd text like this can best be gained if we follow closely the contours of the text. That is to say, we do a kind of close reading of the text. So let's read it. If you take your neighbor's cloak in pawn, you shall restore it before the sun goes down. For it may be your neighbor's only clothing to use as cover. In what else shall that person sleep? And if your neighbor cries out to me, I will listen, for I am compassionate. Now, a flat-footed reading of this text is, this is a law that says that you, if you take your neighbor's cloak in pawn, you shall give it back before the sun goes down. And if we're doing our normal kind of analogy preaching, what would you preach about? You preach against pawnbroking? I mean, what would you preach about on this text? Well, let's follow the contour closely. If you take your neighbor's cloak in pawn. Now notice where this positions you. You are standing right in the middle of the ordinary commerce of the Hebrew world, and you are a person in power because you have taken your neighbor's cloak in pawn. You've taken your neighbor's Visa card to pay for the DVD player. You have taken your neighbor's mortgage as collateral for a loan. You have taken something that belongs to your neighbor as collateral on some important economic transaction. And the voice of God says, you shall restore it before the sun goes down. To which you ought to say, heck no. That's not the way collateral works. To which the voice of God says, it may be your neighbor's only clothing to use for cover. To which you ought to say, exactly, that's why it works as collateral. To which the voice of God says, in what else shall your neighbor sleep? To which you ought to say, not my problem. To which the voice of God says, then I'm going to make it my problem. If your neighbor cries out to me, I will listen, for I am compassionate. Notice what this text has done. It's taken you from the lobby of the Wachovia Bank into the throne room of a compassionate, loving God, and there you are holding your neighbor's coat. Now, I was working on this passage with my students one day, and I was kind of moved. I mean, not just enlightened, I was kind of moved by this being brought right into the presence of the compassion of God in the midst of an economic world. And I drove home thinking about it, and when I got home, there was some mail on the mail table, and I happened to find in the stack a letter from the JCPenney retail credit department. This was when Congress was thinking about tightening up credit card regulations, and credit lenders were trying to get out ahead of the Congress and change their rules before they got grandfathered out. So I thought, well, I better read this. So I read the letter, and what JCPenney Retail Credit told me was that was because I was such a good customer, they were raising my interest to 34% a month. I mean, a year, 34% a year. And at first I thought, well, I pay off my Penny's card every month. I don't care about that. And I threw it, and then I thought, if there ever was taking your neighbor's cloak in pawn, this is it. At least I don't have to be complicit with it. So I called JCPenney, and I said to the woman who answered the phone, I would like to cancel my JCPenney credit card. She said, well, we're certainly sorry to lose you as a customer, sir, but I can handle that for you. She took the information, and then she said, in order that we might provide better customer service to others, would you be willing to share why you have canceled your account? I said, certainly. I believe that you are out of accord with the book of Exodus. She said, what? I could see her with the screen there. Reason customer has declined account. Out of accord with the book of Exodus wasn't on there. I said, look, I'm not trying to be coy, but I teach in a seminary, and we've been looking at the book of Exodus, and it indicates that God stands on the side of the poor here. I said, I'm not concerned about myself. You can look at my record. I pay my card off every month. I said, what I'm thinking about is the single mom who goes to one of your stores because her kids need school clothes, and she can't afford them right then, so she puts them on her JCPenney's card, and you're charging her 34% interest, and she'll never get out from under it. You've turned her into a slave. She said, sir, you have to understand the high cost of doing business in this kind of economic climate. I said, I perfectly understand that, but let me ask you something. What do you think God thinks about your charging 34% interest to that single mom? She said, oh. And then she caught herself, sir, if you ever decide to reapply for a JCPenney's card. But right in that moment, right in that, oh, she saw something and I saw something. I saw a world where single moms don't have to become slaves to put clothes on the backs of their kids. She saw a world where justice rolls down like the water. The acoustical impact of a biblical text to take you into the presence of a just and compassionate God. Now, sometimes it's following the contours of things. Take another example. Look at Matthew 1 here. Now, the birth of Jesus, the Messiah, took place in this way when his mother, Mary, had been engaged to Joseph. But before they'd lived together, she was found to be with child from the Holy Spirit. Her husband, Joseph, being a righteous man and unwilling to expose her to public disgrace, planned to dismiss her quietly. But just when he'd resolved to do this, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, Joseph, son of David, don't be afraid to take Mary as your wife, for the child conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will bear a son, and you are to name him Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. All this took place to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet. Look, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall name him Emmanuel, which means God is with us. When Joseph awoke from sleep, he did as the angel of the Lord commanded him. He took her as his wife, but had no marital relations with her until she had borne a son, and he named him Jesus. Now, don't roller sled through this too fast. Remember that in the acoustical environment of Matthew, they are in a Jewish linguistic world. And Joseph in this passage is called something very important. He is a righteous man. He's a tzaddik. What that means is he is what our faith and the Jewish faith are trying to produce. He not only reads the Bible, he lives the Bible. He's a tzaddik. You may remember in Chaim Potok's book, The Chosen, the young man is telling about his experience with his father, and he says, my father, may he rest in peace, used to tell me about the sufferings of Jerusalem. He would tell me of the torment and the agony of the people, and I wondered why he did this. And one day he said, a tzaddik must suffer in his heart. When everyone else dances and sings, a tzaddik must hold the sufferings of God's people in his heart. Joseph is a tzaddik. He's bar mitzvahed. He's a son of the commandments. You ask him what you should do if somebody bears false witness against somebody else, and he can tell you. You ask him what you should do if someone's ox gores a neighbor's ox. He can tell you. Ask him what you should do if your fiance turns up pregnant and not by you. He knows what to do. And by God, he's going to do it. He's not going to do it in a callous way. He's a tzaddik. He's going to do it with compassion, but he's going to do it. And then the angel disrupts. Joseph, there is more God in this pregnancy than you know. There is more holiness in this scandal than you have ever imagined. You will not put her away. You will take her as your wife, and you will name that baby Jesus because he's going to save his people from their sin. Now Joseph's in a quandary. Is he going to be righteous? Or is he going to be righteous? He did as the angel told him. He took her as his wife. Now, what we have here is an acoustical event in which there is rendered before the Matthean audience the character of who Matthew hopes that they will become by the end of this gospel. Somebody who is a believer in every jot and tittle of the law, but who knows that God does not write with straight lines. And that God is going to fulfill that law in ways that absolutely astonish the entire world. And obedience is moving to a new register, as Jesus says, unless you have more righteousness than the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never see the kingdom of heaven. And it's not just a court more, it's a different kind of righteousness, one that expects the surprises of God. Sometimes we get at the acoustical effect by doing close readings. Sometimes we follow structure and flow of the text. Take a look at Psalm 77, for example. I cry aloud to God that he may hear me. In the day of my trouble, I seek the Lord. In the night, my hand is stretched out without wearying. My soul refuses to be comforted. I think of God and I moan. I meditate and my spirit faints. You keep my eyelids from closing. I'm so troubled I can't speak. I consider the days of old and remember the years of long ago. I commune with my heart in the night. I meditate and search my spirit. Will the Lord spurn forever and never again be favorable? Has God's steadfast love ceased forever? Are God's promises at an end for all time? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has God in anger shut up his compassion? I say, it is my grief that the right hand of the Most High has changed. Let me translate that. It is my grief, God, you don't have any power anymore. I will call to mind the deeds of the Lord. I will remember your wonders of old. I will meditate on all your work and muse on your mighty deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. What God is so great as our God? You are the God who works wonders. You've displayed your might among the peoples. With your strong arm, you redeemed your people, the descendants of Jacob and Joseph. When the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. The very deep trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies thundered. Your arrows flashed on every side. The crash of your thunder was in the whirlwind. Your lightnings lit up the world, the earth trembled and shook. Your way was through the sea, your path through the mighty waters. Yet your footprints were unseen. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. What happened to transform? My grief is, you don't have any more power or compassion or love, to your way, O God, is holy. Something happens in verse 11. He remembers. And it is a different kind of remembering than in verse 5. I consider the days of old and remember the years of long ago. It just simply is digging up bones there. But in 11, it's a different kind. It is a memory of the will. I don't feel like it. In fact, I feel rage and grief and depression. But as an act of the will, I am going to look at the time I remember you were close and loving and powerful. And he looks at the Exodus. He looks at the Exodus. And he turns away. And then he looks at the Exodus and turns away. And he looks at the Exodus. It's an act of the will. He looks. And suddenly, he sees something in the Exodus he had missed. Your way was through the sea. Not around it, not over it, not in spite, but right through it. Your footprints were unseen. Right when you were most powerful, you were less visible. And you led us by the hand of Moses and Aaron. Your help came through the people right around us. He sees it. And it creates a revolution in his understanding not only of God, but himself. Notice that the first part of this psalm is I. I'm so sad. I'm so grief-stricken. I'm so lonely. And the last part of the psalm is you. He moves from internality and its obsessions to the possibility of external praise. When my wife and I moved to Atlanta about 12 years ago now for me to take the job at Emory University, we looked for the right church for our family. We worshiped here and we worshiped there, and finally we decided that we would join or affiliate with Central Presbyterian Church in downtown Atlanta because, well, it had wonderful worship and it had a long and vigorous ministry to the city, and it had all the things that we were kind of looking for. Shortly after we affiliated with the church, our pastor invited all of us who were affiliating or joining the church in that season to come on Wednesday night to have a dinner with the officers. So there we were in the fellowship hall, rectangular table, all of us sitting around having dinner. When dinner was over, the minister said, "I would like for us to go around the table and to say why you're joining Central Church." First person. "Well, I'm a singer. The music program is fantastic here, and I'm really eager to be a part of the choir." Next person. "I have two teenage daughters. The youth program, they tell me, is the hottest in town, and so we're eager for them to have a good experience in the youth group." Next person. "I was in a church where I didn't like the minister. I like the minister here fine." That's the way it went until we got around to Marshall. Ponytail, ear studs. Marshall said, "3 years ago, I was on the street high on crack cocaine. I stumbled into the outreach center of this church begging for help, and the director said, 'I'm sorry, I don't have enough money to put you in a treatment program this month, but if you'll hang on with us for 1 month, I can get you in a program. And if you'll stay with us, we'll stay with you.' And she held my hand and knelt down on the carpet of her office floor and prayed that I would be able to hang on. And I've been sober now for 3 years. And I'm joining this church because Jesus saved me in this church." The rest of us looked at each other sheepishly. We were there for the choir and the parking. He's there for the salvation. About 6 weeks later, I saw in the church newsletter a little squib that said that Marshall was now an inmate in the DeKalb County Jail. We had joined the church together. We were brothers in Christ, so I went to visit him in jail. 3 metal detectors later, I found myself on the opposite side of a thick plate glass window. I had a telephone in my hand. On the other side, in an orange jumpsuit, was Marshall with a telephone in his hand. I said, "Marshall, how are you?" "By the grace of God, I'm doing fine." I said, "Marshall, what happened?" He said, "I was in the outreach center counseling people like myself off the street, and I was telling them that they could do right. And I realized that I hadn't done right myself, not completely. I had an old warrant out here. It was years old. It would never have caught up with me. But on Christmas Eve, I turned myself in because I knew about it. But I'll be out by Easter. And I cannot wait to come and worship on Easter. And in the meantime, I've got a little outreach center going in my cell. He said, a lot of the folks here can't read or write, so I write letters to their wives and sweethearts telling them that they love them. And we have prayer every night for the inmates and the guards even. Not many come, but we pray. And I'm looking through a plate glass window in a guy in a jailbird suit, and I cannot imagine anybody more free than Marshall. Because he found out that God's way is through the sea, and that his footprints are sometimes hidden, and he cares for us through the care of those brothers and sisters that he puts around us. He was living the acoustical impact of this song. Sometimes it's close reading, sometimes it is following the structure and flow, and sometimes it's juxtaposition. Juxtaposition, what do I mean? Juxtaposition is you not only look at your text, but you look at the texts that come before it and after it to see what kind of electricity is flowing among them. For example, this is not on your sheet, but I'll read it to you. It's everybody's favorite stewardship passage in the 12th chapter of Mark. It goes this way. Jesus sat down opposite the treasury and watched the crowd putting money into the treasury. Many rich people put in large sums. A poor widow came and put in 2 small copper coins, which are worth a penny. Then Jesus called his disciples and said to them, "Truly I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who are contributing to the treasury, for all of them have contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, has put in everything she had, all she had to live on." Oh, friends, would that we had this kind of sacrificial giving in our congregation today. And the pledge cards are found in the pew racks in front of you. Wait a minute. Back up and look at what comes before and after. Right before, Jesus is talking to the disciples and he said to them, "I want you to beware of the scribes. They like to walk around in long robes, and they like to be greeted with respect in the marketplace and have the best seats in the synagogue and the places of honor at the banquets. They devour widows' houses." They do? Yeah, they devour widows' houses. And then Jesus sat opposite the treasury. And he watched all the charade giving, and then into the temple arena there came a poor widow, and she reached into her purse and she put her whole house in the temple treasury. And Jesus said to his disciples, "Come here, you see that? What are they supposed to see? The difference between real giving and fraudulent giving? Yes. But they're also supposed to see the difference between a real house of God and one that sucks the blood out of widows." Do they? In the next story, as they are leaving the temple, one of the disciples looks back and says, "Golly, that's a beautiful church." And Jesus says some of the best news in the Gospel of Mark. You see that building? Not one stone will be left standing on another. This is what God does to institutions that suck the blood out of widows. Now that's a really interesting stewardship sermon. One more. We could go on and make a long list, but I won't try your patience. I want to do one more, and that is a preacher should discern the acoustical impact of the text by looking in your passage for the odd things. The odd things. Because it's those elbows to the cheek that make you pay attention, that create an impact. For example, the discussion in Acts of the crowd that was gathered at Pentecost. It sounds like a bus station announcer. Listen, how is it that we hear, each of us, in our own native language? Parthians, Medes, Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt, and parts of Libya, visitors from Rome, all aboard, please. There were Medes at Pentecost? This is the first century. There hadn't been any Medes in the world for hundreds of years. They were as extinct as mastodons. There were Elamites at Pentecost. They didn't wander over from the next county. They wandered over from the Old Testament. To say that there were Medes and Elamites at Pentecost is like saying, you should have been at our church yesterday. We had visitors from Florida, Ohio, California, a whole van load of Assyrians, and a cute little Hittite couple who signed the friendship pen. Acoustically, everybody who ever lived was at Pentecost. The whole human family was there when the Spirit came down. Everybody who ever lived was at Pentecost. The acoustical impact of the biblical text. I wonder if you have any questions. Would love to hear some questions or even some rebuttals if you have those. I think we've got folks with microphones if you want to ask anything.